Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast and happy Cosmonautics Day on this 60th anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's first manned orbital flight. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, Israel's attack on Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment facility and what it means for ongoing nuclear talks, and John Kerry's upcoming trip to Beijing and whether it means a softening of the administration's hard line on China as Beijing increases pressure on Taiwan and Japan's prime minister prepares to become the first foreign leader to visit the Biden White House. But first, joining us, as he does most Mondays, is my good friend Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners. Byron, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be back as always, Vago.
Absolute pleasure, especially after you joining us for the Friday roundtable. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology, and Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our coverage of air and missile defense. Byron, skinny budget is out, as we discussed on Friday's program. Congress is back in session. What should we be paying attention to this week?
There's a lot going on this week in Washington, Vago. I'll kind of do this chronologically, recognizing that some of these events happened today, Monday, so people may have to catch the replay, but Army Chief of Staff General McConville is speaking at a Washington Post event today, Monday. Then the Atlanta Council is rolling out a large space security study with a number of speakers. And the March Treasury report on outlays comes out. That is something that analysts and investors usually look at just to kind of get a sense of how outlays are flowing to defense. Some people focus this on a monthly basis because companies report quarterly. You know, this is really all about the first quarter of 2021. Then on the FY22 budget, CMAS and Reagan Institute are doing an event tomorrow, kind of the trade-offs in the defense budget. I think it'll be interesting because House Armed Services Chairman Smith is going to be speaking in that event. So it'll be kind of the first of his statements on how he sees this all playing out and what he likes and doesn't like in the top line number. Atlanta Council is also doing an event on kind of the new services companies and setting the stage for that landscape. And CSIS has something on the Integrated Defense Review. And I think just as a broader backdrop, it's important to recognize that Secretary of Defense Austin is going to be in Europe this week and visiting Israel. So this geopolitical backdrop about the tension between Russia and Ukraine, and then as you mentioned, you know, you're going to have people addressing the evolving situation with Iran, I'd keep an eye on what comes out of some of those meetings in Europe in particular.
Steve Grundman's Atlantic Council event will be particular. All of those events are going to be interesting, but I'm really looking forward to Steve's event. Each week in your notes, Byron, you do some original research and some original thinking. And this week you wrote about taxes and how the Trump tax cuts impacted the defense industrial base, if you will, or the publicly traded defense and aerospace companies, but then also looked at what tax increases could mean going forward. Obviously, the Biden administration talking about an increase in corporate tax rates as Janet Yellen tries to negotiate some form of global minimum tax structure so that nations don't play the limbo and end up hurting one another from a revenue perspective. Give us some of your thoughts on sort of taxes and the sector.
Well, I think, you know, I was keying off some comments that Greg Hayes of Raytheon Technologies made last week at a Washington Economic Club meeting. He basically implied that given the president's plan to increase taxes, you know, the $5 billion or so that his company spends on capital expenditures and research development, you know, the higher taxes could represent a $1 billion hit to that. And I thought, wait a second, you know, step back and let's look at what happened in 2017 through 2020 on the publicly available data for what the tax cut meant for contractors. And I think the first thing you have to recognize is yes, the effective tax rate, which is what shows up in their income statement, fell. And also taxes paid fell, although that number kind of moves around a lot. And it's a little hard to track because, for example, in 2020, Lockheed Martin only paid $1 million in taxes paid. This is a cash flow item. And I think the other point that was kind of interesting is when you looked at how those tax savings were distributed, they didn't all go to capital expenditures and research and development. They also went to higher dividend payouts. And although share buybacks had kind of withered in 2020 during the pandemic, it's fair to say that at least in the early stages, you saw some sustained share repurchase programs. So presuming that Congress does eventually get around to passing a higher corporate tax rate, it's fair to assume that I think, as we saw, you know, with the corporate tax savings, higher corporate taxes will kind of get spread around all these different uses of cash that companies have. I would not call it a disaster. I'd look at, you know, the longer term research development spending patterns that these companies were evidencing. They were increasing research and development well before the 2017 tax cut as a percent of sales. So I just look, this is something, you know, they'll manage. I think any company that said they were going to just slash research development and capital expenditures as a result of higher taxes is sending a suicide note to their shareholders, because in this kind of competitive environment, that's probably the last thing you want to be doing.
Byron, always a pleasure having you on. Thanks very much, and hope you can join us on Friday.
You got it. Thank you, Bago.
And joining us now are two of the nation's leading Asia experts, Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute Think Tank, and Randy Shriver, who served as the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs in the Trump administration. He's with the Pacific Solutions Consultancy and also the chairman of the Project 2049 Institute to fully normalize relations between the United States and Taiwan. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us again.
It's good to be here, Bago.
Happy to join you.
Things are moving fast and furious weeks after the clash between top Biden administration officials and their Chinese counterparts in Anchorage. The White House's top climate official, former Secretary of State John Kerry, is planning a trip to Beijing to reignite climate cooperation between Washington and Beijing. The administration says that this this move is in step with its strategy to confront where necessary, but also cooperate where possible. Others worry that this move is going to mark a softening of the administration's line, as it did during the Obama administration, where the White House and Kerry prioritized climate and nuclear deal, you know, the Iran nuclear deal, over confronting Beijing over its bad behavior, whether in regional security, island building, economic malfeasance, or cyber warfare. Patrick, are critics right to worry that after a show of strength, this administration may be finding a way to back down?
Well, we should continue to watch very closely this space, but all policy discussions, especially climate change or anything with China, are overshadowed by other matters, in this case, geopolitical competition. So there's no way that John Kerry, as special envoy with one mission, who likes to talk about climate change as a critical standalone issue, can get away with compartmentalizing this issue, and the Chinese won't let him either. And that's really one of the big challenges. It makes perfect sense for the special envoy, John Kerry, to travel to the big Asian countries to suss out what the biggest emitters' appetite is for possibly being more aggressive about CO2 targets. In particular, China's talked about 2060, which is way out there for becoming carbon neutral. And you're going to get a different message when Prime Minister Suga comes to the White House and they talk about a nearer term target. And you have President Biden about to host an Earth Day virtual summit of leaders on this issue. That's an early test, Vago, of which way the winds are going to blow here. Is China going to play ball and be willing to compartmentalize this issue and show some cooperation on climate change? Or is it going to hold it hostage to America's rhetoric and actions over China's human rights abuses, political oppression, et cetera? So the second point here is really that it's a lot easier to, frankly, disrupt, confront, compete than to cooperate in U.S.-China relations at the moment. And this is really the interesting test for John Kerry. Can he come away from Shanghai, assuming he's even there and able to have these discussions, with any semblance of Chinese cooperation, which we'll see or not see at this virtual Earth Day summit on the 22nd, 23rd of April?
Randy?
Well, I agree with Patrick very much. It's a normal thing for the two largest emitters in the world to be talking with one another, explore whether or not cooperation is possible. But, you know, I've always felt the Chinese either believe this is an existential threat or they don't. If they do, there shouldn't be a price of entry. We shouldn't have to persuade them to cooperate or accommodate in some policy matter in the hopes that they cooperate. If they don't, it's going to be endless manipulation, and I can guarantee you it won't be a standalone issue. They will attempt to link a whole variety of issues to their potential cooperation. So, you know, if this is, as many in the scientific community describe it, we shouldn't have to buy China's cooperation at all. They should be eager to come up with an equitable plan with us and with the international community. So we'll see.
Vago, can I just
go ahead?
You know, opine on that, because I agree with Randy, but I think, and I think Randy might agree with this, that Xi Jinping wants to impose his rules on the relationship. And those rules are not the common sense rules that Randy just suggested they should be, but rather it's United States, you show China greater respect and deference by doing what we want and stop doing what we don't want you to do, in order for us to take the actions that we were probably going to take anyway, but we'll right. wrap them in a nice bow to show that this is goodwill cooperation, symbols of, you know, our concession that we're supposedly making, even though we're not actually making them. That's the problem. That's such a challenge for any administration, and it is for Kerry and Biden right now.
I find it interesting that given how polluted Chinese cities are and how big the environmental issues are there, that the Chinese would want, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons why they're leading in some of clean energy technology, is that they acknowledge that they have a big problem, right? I mean, so on the one hand, you have this sort of yin and yang, no pun intended, of sort of, it's a problem, we have to address it, we're going to address it on our terms. Speaking of bargaining chips, Beijing has really been ratcheting up its regional provocations, no other way to put it, certainly trying, as friends of mine have suggested, you know, trying to precipitate a reaction from Taipei in its ever more aggressive violations of Taiwanese air and sea space. We recently had the Chinese carrier battle group sail do its own freedom of navigation operations through the Senkakus. I want to discuss that in the next question, which is about Suga. But Randy, give us your sense, right? I mean, there are those who look at this and say, after Beijing crushed Hong Kong, the next target on Xi's list is either physically or otherwise taking Taiwan, something that becomes more attractive, for example, given the U.S. dependency on Taiwanese semiconductors, some folks point out. Others say, look, just as the Indo-Pacific commander Phil Davidson has said, you know, this is a little bit in the future. It's not an immediate thing. China is not going to invade Taiwan. How do you see this and how this is evolving?
They clearly want Taiwan back in their minds. Taiwan is a renegade province, and there's unfinished business from the Civil War. They may or may not have a timeline that's in the near future. I think they want to create the impression that such a timeline exists and that they are ramping up activity, because at the end of the day, their goal remains to win without fighting. They want to raise doubts in the minds of Taiwanese that the United States will abandon them. They want to raise doubts that their president is leading them into conflict by political provocations. But I still believe the Chinese are not eager for a fight here for a lot of reasons. Even a victory would be highly costly in terms of blood and treasure, but also international reputation. But I don't think it's certain that they win at this point. Phil Davidson said 6 years, they might be able to operationalize this contingency. It may be a little longer, but it's not today, probably. So I think we are seeing increased pressure, but it's still largely designed to create the political conditions for a possible win without fighting.
Patrick?
Well, I agree with Randy. I mean, we have to remain steadfast on the issue of deterrence. We heard Secretary Blinken over the weekend talk about the danger of testing U.S. resolve. That's a good way to throw a reaffirmation of the commitment to Taiwan's peace and security out. But the big and best move for the United States and U.S. allies is to strengthen Taiwan's political, economic, and technological power. because this is a longer game for them. So, you know, using the fact that they're members of APEC in a World Trade Organization member to make sure that Taiwan's included in regional discussions on digital trade, including semiconductor supply chain security, something that's going to come up in the Suga-Biden summit. That's the better course for the United States and allies to take to provide real strength and confidence to Taiwan going forward.
Let me take you to the Suga visit. Patrick, why don't you start us off on this one? I mean, Japan is in sort of a delicate position, as are a lot of countries, right? I mean, they want to stand up to China, but they also see that as their number one trading partner and somebody who can make life economically miserable. Ask the Australians. China's Australia's number one trading partner. Germany's industrial and trade concerns have driven the EU-Beijing trade deal, which is now on ice in the wake of EU accepting U.S. sanctions over what's happened to the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. What are the messages that Suga, you know, and Japanese territorial waters from Japan's perspective or are either being violated or in danger of being violated around the Senkakus as the Chinese sort of assert themselves? What are the messages Suga is bringing to Washington? What does he want from Washington? What does Biden want from and the administration want from Japan?
Well, I think both leaders want to show that their relationship, their alliance, is at the center of Japan and U.S. foreign policy. And that's going to be in sharp contrast to the fact that we'll have a cabinet official in Shanghai, presumably, in terms of John Kerry's visit to China, whereas you've got the Prime Minister of Japan stepping in the White House as the first foreign leader to visit President Biden. And I think this is the symbolism they really want. That is, U.S., China, you're going to have to deal China, you're going to have to deal with the U.S. and Japan alliance and other allies and partners in the region and around the world if you're going to want to compete. And you're not going to be able to get away with disinformation or human rights abuses or your gray zone nibbling strategy in the region. It is largely this security issue, this defense issue, though, that is the toughest nut to crack. So whether it's around the Senkaku Islands, whether it's in the South China Sea and at Whitsun Reef in the Spratly Islands, whether it's in the Taiwan Strait, trying to do two things here. One is to impose costs on China's nibbling gray zone tactics. And secondly, at the same time, deterring Beijing from eventually leaping 6 years or later to conventional aggression. And that's the alliance priority. So what actions need to be taken? I think we're not going to see a lot of statements about that. We're going to see more about the supply chain vulnerabilities being strengthened in terms of semiconductor chips, for instance, if not rare earth metals and other areas. But we're going to see at least hints about a combined forces command, about how to build out the Quad cooperation for maritime deterrence, how to provide countries like the Philippines with the information they need, more maritime domain awareness so that actually they know the hulls of the maritime militia ships at Whitsun Reef. So we can show that this is indeed China's third Navy at work, not some fishing fleet hiding from a storm. I think those are the kinds of strong statements. And I think ultimately we could see a statement like Prime Minister Suga saying, hey, an attack on U.S. forces in Japan would be considered an attack on Japan. That would be in reciprocity for the Article 5 commitment that the United States has for Japan, including over the Senkakus, a way to not just set up Japan and the U.S. to defend the Senkaku scenario, but also over potential Taiwan scenarios down the road.
Well, I think it is an important visit in that it is the first, and it's highly symbolic for those reasons. The reality is we've been on a particular trajectory with the Japanese where we have placed the China challenge really as the organizing principle for our alliance and how we think about the future fight, our national defense strategy, their national defense program guidelines, and the recent update there make that clear. There are sensitive issues, and as you mentioned, people who trade with China a lot don't look for ways to poke them in the eye for no reason, but certainly at the 2+2, the mention of Taiwan was important and perhaps precedent setting, the willingness of the Prime Minister to talk about human rights. All these things are, for me, a sort of a continuity of Alliance work on the China challenge, and I'm encouraged by it. I think this will be an important visit. I think Patrick's right. They're going to spend some time looking at supply chains, but not just the vulnerabilities. That's certainly a part of it, but also the race ahead. How do we, as to large economies, but also technologically advanced economies, out innovate? How do we work with one another, find the synergies, and really stay ahead, in addition to protecting against vulnerabilities?
We've got about 45 seconds left. And Patrick, you've got a point on North Korea. Go ahead.
Well, I think deterring North Korean provocations continues to be a real prospect, especially given the fact that North Korea seems to be having a health crisis right now that Kim Jong-un's hinted at. And diplomacy with the South is going nowhere, or with the United States, for that matter. Meanwhile, President Moon just signed a 6-year deal with the United States, a new special measures agreement for host nation support of U.S. forces. So this is a good time for Suga, when he's at the White House, to talk about North Korea, but also about potential trilateral cooperation among Japan, South Korea, and the United States.
Absolutely critical. And unfortunately, over the decades, we've seen too many tensions between Seoul and Tokyo over historical matters that have impeded the kind of cooperation necessary. Guys, thanks very, very much. Really appreciate having you both on. Look forward to having you back on again. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Vago.
Thank you, Vago.
And joining us again this week is Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council, fresh from his trip to Morocco to discuss Israel's latest attack to delay Iran's nuclear program. According to reports, a massive explosion knocked out power to the Natanz uranium enrichment facility, potentially setting back Tehran's nuclear program by 9 months to a year. Ilan, great to have you back on again.
Great to be back, and great to be back so soon.
Exactly. I'm glad you had a productive trip to Morocco, and I'll ask you a question a little bit later on that. But we did discuss a little bit on some of the concerns from a wider Middle East perspective on what's going on in the region, and especially with the Iranians. But let's talk about this latest attack, right? I mean, last week we talked about Israel's mining attack on the Saviz in the Red Sea, an Iranian ship that Tehran says is fighting piracy, but most say is affiliated with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Last year, Israel assassinated on Iranian territory Iran's top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Farikadze. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is in Israel. In fact, when the news of the latest Natanz setback was announced, obviously the administration wants to renew the Iran nuclear deal. Israel doesn't. But that said, this attack didn't happen overnight. What does the attack mean, Ilan? And is the administration benefiting, if not actually colluding with Israel, to put pressure on Iran?
Right. Well, I think that's really the central question. And I think colluding is probably too strong of a word, but there is a really interesting dynamic that's emerging here. First of all, like you said, this is not something that happened overnight. Unlike the Saviz attack, this type of sabotage at the Natanz facility is likely to have taken a very long time to plan, sort of long before even engagement between the EU and Iran and the United States and the EU in Vienna. And this is sort of, you know, the pattern that we're following here is sort of, it looks reminiscent of the type of clandestine activity that took place a decade ago when we were talking about the Stuxnet cyberworm against the Iranian nuclear complex. But that said, what I think is emerging here is a really interesting pattern of Israeli activism. It's very clear from the Saviz attack last week, from this sort of effort to sabotage Natanz, that the Israelis are increasingly active in sort of asymmetric avenues that are designed to retard Iran's nuclear program and are designed to sort of to frustrate or subvert Iranian regional activities. And what you're seeing is, I think, an emerging pattern of Israeli activism that's set against the backdrop of US negotiations, certainly, but it's almost independent of it. The Israelis have figured out that the Iranian nuclear program and Iranian regional activities are gathering steam, and they're more and more willing to act independently against it.
How does this play out in terms of the negotiations, right? I mean, the Iranians are crying nuclear terrorism. I think that that's actually remarkably funny, or maybe not funny, depending on how you're looking at it, right? How does this play out in terms of the talks and resuming the deal and what shape it takes, right? Because the Iranians are pretty savvy negotiators in their own right.
So I think that's a great question, and it relates back to sort of to my first answer. Obviously, the type of Israeli activism you're seeing is this sort of this independent streak, this willingness by the Israelis to pursue independent action against Iran's nuclear program, against their regional activities. But this independent strategy is actually rebounding to the benefit of the United States, because we have to remember that the urgency with which the Biden administration has sought to re-engage with Tehran is driven largely by Iran's nuclear development, the fact that Iran is enriching uranium to ever higher percentages in terms of purity, that Iran is installing additional centrifuges in facilities like Natanz, right? This was the core logic underpinning the Biden administration's rapid desire to return to the confines of the JCPOA and to start to re-engage with Iran. So what you have is, as an ancillary benefit, is that this Israeli sabotage, which they, you know, sort of, I think, very spectacularly have talked about publicly, which is something new, because we still don't have proper attribution on Stuxnet of a decade ago. So the fact that the Israelis are talking about it publicly is, I think, very striking. But it's also striking because it rebounds to the benefit of the United States, because it tamps down the urgency for the U.S. to engage, because Iran is having all sorts of problems with their nuclear processes as a result of what Israel has done. And they're not out of the box quite as quickly as the West was thinking.
Well, I mean, I do think officially, right, the Israeli government has neither confirmed nor denied. But I mean, certainly there's been a lot of communication about what happened and how it may have happened. Let's talk a little bit about gray zone, right? Gray zone warfare, because this has been heating up. It's something that the Iranians are very expert at, right? I mean, at some point, there will American interests will be targeted just like Israeli interests will be targeted by the Iranians. You know, it's just that there is significant disorganization across their, you know, Shia crescent, which they use as a weapon, as King Abdullah so aptly put it some decade and a half ago. How can we expect Iran to respond? Because right. They will respond at some point.
No, that's exactly right. And so the first point that has to be made is the fact that, you know, this gray zone warfare across the Middle East is heating up, right? Everywhere from Iran's nuclear program to Yemen to Shiite militias in Iraq, you're seeing more and more asymmetric activity that's happening on the sub-state level. This is the game that the Iranians have been playing in recent years, and it's increasingly the game or the battlefield at which countries like Israel are willing to join the fight against Iran. And so that's a trend line that I think is likely to build over time, because as conflict becomes less and less palatable, sort of at the top level of escalation, it empowers conflict at lower levels of escalation, right? And this is sort of the trend line that we're seeing in the Middle East as well. But you're absolutely right. Iran has a tremendous amount of latent capability to engage in gray zone warfare throughout the region. Iran has assets in various countries around the region that it is likely to activate to act against Israeli interests or to act against Western interests. And this is one to watch. It's why when we talked about this last week in the context of the Sabah attack, the macro point was the fact that while the U.S. is very, very focused on Iran's nuclear program and the need to delay and if not derail, then at least to slow down Iran's nuclear drive, where the rubber meets the road in strategic terms isn't on the nuclear front. It's on all these different asymmetric ways that Iran can reach out and touch U.S. allies and U.S. interests throughout the region. And that's a front that's heating up.
And very briefly, give us a sense on your visit to Morocco. You know, we did talk a little bit about it in terms of the Moroccans. I should point out America's oldest allies, first nation to recognize the United States of America. What were some of the messages that senior Moroccan officials were giving you?
Well, it's interesting. And in the context of this conversation, one of the most striking ones was the degree to which officials in Rabat are now concerned about what they're seeing in terms of Iranian activism throughout Africa. I had one high-ranking official tell me, the era in which we could talk about Iran being active in West Africa is over. They're increasingly active all over the continent. Because right. they see an opening here. They see an America that doesn't really have an Africa strategy. They see, you know, this dislocation that's created by the pandemic. And they're trying to sort of to insinuate themselves into local politics, try to expand their ambit, both in terms of sort of political and economic influence, but also because they see Africa more and more as a front in sort of in the larger geopolitical competition. You know, a few years ago, they were content with being focused on the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. Increasingly, though, they're beginning to look west.
Let me ask you one last question about Israel, if I may. The Israelis clearly are pursuing and have always pursued their own strategy, right? I mean, Ilan Gan is looking to Washington and asking for Washington's blessing, nor being terribly troubled whether Washington likes anything, right? I mean, Bibi Netanyahu sat next to Barack Obama, who was trying to do a peace deal, lecture him, and then the U.S. Congress backed Netanyahu over the president, right? Ultimately, whenever Israel and any nation does something like this, right, their chit's in the bank. How do you think Israel's clandestine and gray zone operations, right? What is the ask from Jerusalem? There will be an ask from Jerusalem for this, right? These are mitzvahs. How does that get cashed in? How does that manifest itself? And how does that in turn shape U.S. strategy or policy, whether toward Iraq or anything else?
Well, so it's an interesting question. And I'd only point out that a mitzvah doesn't require a quid pro quo, but
that's true. That's true. It is not transacted. It is a good deed for the sake of it.
There's a good deed for the sake of it. And maybe this is that, but what I actually see this as is a broader conversation that the Israelis are having internally about the shifting political dynamics in the region. Because even though the Biden administration is not focused quite as much as it should be on the normalization that was sort of, you know, began to be manifest in the last 8 months or so between Israel and Bahrain and the UAE and other countries, there's increasingly this sort of independent dialogue that's going on. In fact, when Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin was in Israel, one of the pledges that the Israeli prime minister made to him was to increase the quota of Israeli water that's apportioned to neighboring Jordan, right? Which is a sort of a little bit out of left field, but it's also a testament to how interconnected everything is, right? Israel is making pains to position itself as a constructive regional partner. It's having all these independent conversations with the Gulf states that are sort of, they're not dependent on what Washington does, but obviously they are sort of impacted by what Washington does. And I think the Israelis are, in their own subtle or not so subtle ways, they're trying to shape the regional context in ways that benefit them and their new allies.
Ilan, always a pleasure having you on. Thanks very much for joining us, especially back to back like this. Thanks a lot. And always look forward to having you back on.
Oh, my pleasure. Anytime.
And I should say to all of our Muslim listeners, Ramadan Mubarak, given Ramadan starts tomorrow.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.